Okay, so are there any questions? There is this talk on Monday, next Monday. I'll remind you guys again on Thursday's class, but so Dana now would be giving planning for interactions among autonomous agents. And I know it's not during the class time, but if you can make it at all, I'll encourage you highly to attend. It's in 2:10. Any questions on belief state search, belief space search? Okay, so what I would try to do today is last time we kind of established the difference between belief space search with and without sensing actions, and we started talking about what would be involved in applying an action to a belief space, a causative action. Okay, because we are talking about situations where you don't have sensing action. And as you remember, it's the sensing actions which change the type of plan from a sequential plan to something else, which actually involves branching. So you sense and do something else. Okay, unless you have sensing actions, plans are always sequence of actions. Okay, we will get to the sensing action probably in 10-15 minutes, or maybe 15-20 minutes in this class. But first, we were talking last time about if I get you the state belief states directly in terms of the state identifier. So if each belief state is given as S1, S5, S7, let's say, how would you go about applying? Doing search on them, and we talked about the issue that if you have a belief space and you have an action, now this action can be deterministic or non-deterministic. Much of what we did last time was to point out that belief space search remains essentially the essentials of belief space search remain the same whether you have uncertainty in the initial state or whether you have non-determinism in the actions. Okay, of course there are all sorts of interesting issues, such as if you only have deterministic actions, then the uncertainty cannot increase during planning. It can only reduce. Okay. Whereas if you have non-deterministic actions, then the uncertainty can both increase and reduce. Where here I'm talking by uncertainty, all I mean is the cardinality of the belief state. How many states are there in each belief state? Okay. If it's one, that means you have no uncertainty. Okay. So we were so in fact today when I give examples, I'll tend to talk about deterministic actions and belief states. Okay, but the examples will also work when you have non-deterministic actions. Okay, so it's the same idea. Okay, so the belief states we talked last time about mostly directly in terms of explicit representations. That means belief states as list of states, the set of states, and then towards the end of last class we started talking about the fact that we might actually want to represent the states as a logical formula, because if you consider each state to be essentially a conjunction of the literals that are true, I mean the valuation of the literal, so if it's Boolean then you can just talk about the conjunction of the literals that are true and the literals that are false. That's basically your a complete state, then a belief state is a disjunction over these interpretations. Any subset of them is a belief state. Okay. Now, obviously, if you have a subset of these states, then they correspond to some arbitrary logical formula. Okay. In fact, we are going the opposite way. Normally, logical formulas are defined in terms of their models, in terms of the interpretations where they evaluate to true. Okay, now I'm telling you if you know belief state in terms of the actual states, then what you have is the extensional representation, right? But you may actually start from like a general logical formula which corresponds exactly, whose extension corresponds to the exact set of states in your initial belief state, and then you can apply actions directly to that. Okay, do regression and progression on them. Okay. So the search now would be mostly The search now would be mostly in terms of logical formulas as again as complete interpretations. So if you think of classical planning, it was also, the progression can be thought of as you start with a complete conjunction, apply an action, you get another complete conjunction. Okay? Regression, on the other hand, starts with an incomplete conjunction, regresses the action and gets another incomplete conjunction. Okay? So those are all logical formulas. Here you actually get more general logical formulas. Okay, that's basically the only difference. One thing that I mentioned last time was obviously there are many more logical formulas because there are many more subsets of states than there are states themselves. And what's more problematic is that actually you could have multiple logical formulas which actually are equivalent. Do you understand what I'm saying? And so not only are there 2^2 n potential subsets of states, so if there are n state variables, then there are 2^n interpretations. That means there are that each of them corresponds to a complete state. So then there are 2^2 n sets of states. Now for each set of state, each particular belief space or belief state, there is you could write any number of logical formulas that are all equivalent in the sense their extension corresponds exactly that. Okay. So now one issue of course is during search, if you wind up seeing the same logical formula again and again, and you want to cut down the cycles, the cycle finding is much harder now because you are now considering equivalence of logical formulas, arbitrary logical formulas. Okay? So these are, so at some abstract level things are very similar to state space search, but things do become, the specific subroutines become quite hard. Okay? Because you now are going to be considering, for example, something like duplicate elimination now, even in state space search, will now be checking equivalence of logical formulas. Okay. Now one thing that I did mention last time is if I don't want to deal with all arbitrarily ugly looking logical formulas, can I just somehow look at subset of all the logical formulas? Now one way you could do it is if you can restrict the uncertainty in the initial state. If you restrict the uncertainty in the initial state such that all you would say about an initial state is, so initial state is, when I say initial state, now I'm talking about initial belief state. Okay? If I say that my initial belief state is exactly representable as a set of literals whose values I know and a set of literals whose values I don't know. Okay? So suppose if I have my state variables are P, Q, R, and S, then I can say P, Q, and R are known, S I don't know. In that case, really, it's just P and Q and R is my belief state. Because, it can, S or not S would be consistent with it. Okay? If you consider just that, so essentially now, to be able to get this, you are saying the only uncertainty in the belief state must be representable as not knowing a specific variable. Okay? If you do that, then of course, you're going to only have to deal with 3^n states because the conjunctions now are just, it's a partial conjunction. Each belief state can be represented as a partial conjunction. Okay. Now what you are giving up in doing this is, of course, you don't get to represent all belief states correctly. What if I tell you that P is definitely true, Q is definitely true, and R exclusive R S is true. That means either R is true or S is true, but not, both are not true. Okay. Now in that case, you cannot write that directly as a partial conjunction. Okay. So that's something that you're unable to explain. So in general, if you give any random subsets of states, you cannot represent it as a partial conjunction. So you have to give up on something. Okay. But if you can get by with this, if you can approximate your uncertainty in this way, then there's a smaller state space. And people try sometimes just approximating their uncertainty this way just to reduce the search. Okay. Now, again, this is basically pointing out that you had dealt with the partial conjunctions when you did regression in classical planning. But there, not knowing, not caring about a particular variable is a boon. That means you didn't have to deal with it. Okay. Here, you actually not knowing a variable means you have multiple states that you have to deal with, in a sense. Okay. Okay. So, belief space planners, if you don't make this assumption, then belief space planners generally have to search in the space of full formulas, full logical formulas. Okay. And then there are obvious headaches. One issue, of course, is repeated search states, and would you even be able to tell that you've seen this search state before? Okay, if you are keeping the logical formula in some random form. Okay, now this is where since states are belief states are now arbitrary logical formulas, and you know effective representations for logical formulas become important. Okay. Now, effectively representing logical formulas, efficiently representing them is a big deal for lots and lots of people. But we will wind up intersecting that in this class because you essentially have to represent belief states, which can be general logical formulas. And so you normally wind up converting things into canonical forms. Given a logical formula, you convert into a canonical form. Okay. There are two canonical forms that you should already know. CNF and DNF. Okay. Now, however, they are canonical in the sense that every formula can be converted into CNF or DNF form, but they are not unique. Okay. So there is another one called binary decision diagrams, or reduced order binary decision diagrams. Depending on how things go, we might wind up spending more time reading about them. But you know, it's essentially it's one of those things where we intersect, our interests intersect with BDDs here. Okay, I'll tell you a little about BDDs. But some of you, do any of you know binary decision diagrams? None of you know. Okay, it's like a big deal in model checking communities, and it winds up being quite useful for us too in this case because, and as far as we are concerned. A binary decision diagram is a particular canonical representation for any logical formula, except it also happens to be unique once you decide the ordering of the variables. Okay. So here is a simple example. If you consider the formula P implies Q and P implies S, that's the general logical formula now. Okay, I'm just looking at normal propositional logical formulas. You know, CNF representation would look like that. A CNF is a conjunction of disjunctive clauses. Okay? And then a DNF representation would look like that. DNF is disjunction of conjunctive clauses. Now, here's a cute thing. Actually, if you look at the DNF representation, each of the constituents of the DNF representation looks like a partial state, a partial conjunction. Right? Okay. So, and since progression is actually quite easily described in conjunctive states, you will notice that in fact DNF representations are quite useful if you are doing progression directly. Okay. And you might wind up using CNF representations if you are doing regression for similar reasons. And then as far as the BDDs are concerned, one advantage of them in this case, so for example, a BDD would look like this, for example, in this case. Okay, so this is just a tree representation, and if you have set an order on the variables, given an order on the variables that you stick to, then any two arbitrary logical formulas that are equivalent will get converted to the exact same BDD. Okay. So you can almost check equivalence by hashing. Okay, essentially it's the same tree. Okay, that's the big deal about BDDs. Furthermore, the other interesting reason about BDDs, there are a lot more other reasons. One of the bigger reasons is that many logical operations wind up becoming simple graph operations on the BDD. Okay. So anyway, so BDD is really a disjunction of conjunctive path formula. So you essentially say if P is true and Q is true and S is true, it's 1. If P is true, Q is true, S is false, it's 0. If P is false, it's 1. If P is true and Q is false, it's 0. Okay? And so in some way, in one way of thinking about it is actually taking the DNF representation and writing each path here corresponds to the path in the DNF. And then you just make sure that if there are repeated nodes, you don't have more than one S in the tree. Okay? Again, you know, the guy who got Turing Award this year is Ed Clark. And one of his main claims to fame is model checking. And afterwards, actually, Randy Bryant is actually the guy who is credited for the BDD's work. So he did not get the Turing Award this time, but I think Ed Clark actually wrote the book on model checking, which talks a lot about BDD. Okay. As far as we are concerned, the reason we are interested in it is that it can be a canonical representation to check, and so it will help you in doing state reputation checks. Okay. Having said this, I won't come back to it for the next few slides because I'll first explain to you progression and regression in the simple CNF-DNF formula. Okay. So here, I'm going to just some examples here. So I'm going to do, in this case, you know, an action A1 which requires precondition M, and if P is true, it gives K, and it also, this one also requires M, if Q is true, it gives K, this also requires M, R is true, it gives L. And so on. So there's a bunch of actions there. None of these actions in this case are non-deterministic. They're all deterministic. Okay. I could do this problem this kind of an example with non-deterministic actions too. As far as the underlying machinery is concerned, nothing changes. Okay. Because you will still be searching in the space of belief states. So I'm doing a simpler example here. But I do start with an initial state which has uncertainty. If initial state also doesn't have uncertainty, then it's classical planning. Okay. So M is true and exactly one of P, Q, and R are true. That's what I've said. Okay. So in some sense, since it's only one of P, Q, and R are true, this cannot be written as the simple partial state. Okay. So here is my initial state formula. So P, Q, where didn't I write M here? No, M is here, okay, and then this whole thing. So P and not Q and not R, or not P and Q and not R, or not P and not Q and R, the whole thing conjoined with M. That's my formula. That's my initial state formula, right? Okay, and every state consistent with it, every interpretation of that formula is an initial state. Okay. Now, at the minimum, you have to realize the following thing. So first of all, what am I trying to do here? You know, if I have no sensing actions and I'm searching in the space of belief states, the only reasonable planning problems I can define, as I said at the end of last class, are strong and weak plans. A strong plan is one where I reach a state where every state in that belief state is part of the goal belief state. Okay, so if the goal belief state says get to either S7 or S8 or S9, and if I reach a belief state which says you are either in S8 or S9, then you're done. Right? Okay? So basically, and then the strong means every state in the current belief state is a subset, belongs to the goal belief state. Okay. And weak means that a superset. This is a superset of the goal state. Okay. Now we'll only focus on strong belief state and strong solutions. Okay. As I said, weak solutions don't make any sense because all it says is there may be a path. It doesn't talk about probabilities. You know, how often are you going to go to the goal state if you do this planning? Okay. So this particular initial state corresponds to two different, here are the two different canonical representations. One is DNF, one is CNF. And when I'm doing a progression, I would use the DNF representation because it's actually much simpler to think of progressing the action on each of the constituents. And then disjoining the result. Okay? And when I'm doing regression, it turns out CNF is slightly better. Okay? So here's the progression example. So this one is essentially just saying what I said in terms of progression and regression, one being better for DNF, one for CNF. Now, one big thing, actually we'll get to it in a minute, when you do regression with CNF, the big difference is if you were regressing in the classical planning and if you had a disjunction, you could split the disjunction into the search space. Because in the event, eventually either P is true or Q is true. So if you regress a state, a formula, because remember in the classical planning also you only had a belief, you know, in essence a set of states, which can be thought of as a belief state. Okay? So when you regressed an action over that state, regressed that belief state over this action, you got another logical formula. Sometimes that logical formula might contain disjunction. But you could split the disjunction into the search space and only keep conjunction in each branch. Why? Because ultimately, if you are trying to achieve P or Q, you would do it either by achieving P or by achieving Q. You would know which one you did. Whereas if you do not know, if you don't have full observability, if you don't know your initial state, then it may well be that all I will tell you is that in the initial state, P or Q is true. I don't know which one is true. Then if you split yourself up front, then the goal says that says you must have P true, that path will fail. And the path that says you must have Q true, that will also fail. Whereas if you did not split, it would have succeeded. Is this clear? Okay, so that's the big difference when you have incomplete initial state, basically when you don't have full observability, then you cannot split disjunction. So you essentially have to carry these logical formulas around. In the normal classical regression, you could if you wanted, or you could also just split it into the search space to make life simple. Make life simple meaning make per node handling simple. Okay? So anyway, here is a progression example for that one I'm talking about. So, and I wish I showed you this, these are the actions. I should have put them there again, but I put the actions I'm using. So if I go from this belief state and I apply this action, which requires M as a precondition, and if R is true, it gives L. So I can do this by essentially applying this to each of the constituents and then disjoining them. Okay, so that's my that's where I come here, and then here I applied A5, which is L. If L is true, then G is true, and then I got another set of constituents. Okay, now notice that I get to stop if my DNF representation entails the goal formula. Okay, and what was my goal formula? Goal formula is G. That's basically what I wanted in this case. Okay, I don't know whether you noticed, need G. Okay, so here essentially, this basically is a, this whole thing disjoined with this whole thing disjoined with this whole thing. And one of the disjuncts already gives G. So if you can make sure that the other two also, then you're done. Okay. So that's basically what you do in your, so it's an entailment check always, and it's more interesting entailment check now, whereas in classical planning it was too obvious. Okay. Now for the regression search, for the same thing, I believe it's the same thing, yeah. So I start with G, okay, and I applied A4 because A4 does give G if K is true. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things is that normally, if this was classical planning, I could essentially say when I put in A4, I would basically only require K to be true before A4. Okay, the regressed weakest state before A4, that must be true, such that after A4, G would be true, is K. Okay, but in general here it may well be the case that you will never be able to observe K. And so what we would wind up doing is you write GRK, which is still regressed, there's nothing wrong, this is still at the weakest state, right? Because K entails GRK. Okay. Oh my God, I know it's going to like that. So this is basically all I'm doing is not splitting the disjunction into the search space. Okay. And then I put an A5, I get GRKRL for the same reason. And then A1, and then so now in the case when I put in A1, I have this entire clause as well as M being added. M is a separate part because that's the precondition of A1. Okay, and so you notice that this disjunction is just increasing, but it's becoming, you know, you are essentially weakening the goal. This is progress. What you originally wanted was G must be true. Now you are saying, I don't need G to be true. It's fine enough if you make either G or K true. By here you are saying, it's fine enough if you make G or K or L true. And by here you are saying, if you make either G or K or L or P or Q true and M also true, then I'm done. That's what regression is supposed to do. In trying to achieve the goal, you are splitting it into something that you can actually make true faster. Okay. And so at this point, after I also regress over A3, then it turns out that each of the clauses of the goal state are satisfied in the initial state. So you can stop. Okay. Again, all I want is an entailment check. What I want is, this is a logical formula. Here is initial state. If initial state entails this logical formula, I'm done. Right? That's what you do in regression. You want to make sure that what is true in the initial state already entails what you are trying to achieve. Okay? Anyway, so that's all I'm basically trying to show is you could do progression and regression. Yes, sir. What?
All the initial state formula must be true there. So how do we obtain those?
No, because initial state currently is in the CNF form. These are not states. So the initial states is this and this and this and this and this. Okay. So by the time you have logical formulas, forget about states now. All you want is initial state. This state must entail this. This formula must entail this formula. That's all. It's a good question. I mean, if you're asking that, you are at least getting the right kind of confusion, which is basically, initial state seen as a set of states. It's sort of a disjunct, essentially an inherently disjunct representation. So that would make you think that for some each state, you should have a path to some goal-bearing state. That's true. Okay, but then, we are essentially considering them together, and this is a logical formula that corresponds exactly to all the sets. So all I'm saying is that if this entails your goal belief state, that means every state that is in this belief state is present here. Wait. Did I confuse you? Let's get the explicit version first. So in the explicit version, if the goal states are SG, the goal belief state currently is S1 and S2, okay? And so it's basically saying you should be either in S1 or S2, okay? You should be either in the state S1 or S2. And if the initial state says S1, S2, S3, that's not going to cut it, right? Because there is more uncertainty here and you want less uncertainty, okay? Whereas if the initial state says S1, S2, that's fine, Or if you just say S1, then also it's fine. Okay. Either way, all I am saying is that if you just think in terms of these, S1 entails S1 or S2. From a logical formula point of view, S1 entails S1 or S2. That's what I'm checking. Okay? Now, so you could do progression and regression like this. In fact, you can also do, this planning, of course, this kind of, without sensing, doing planning in the belief space, as I said, is called conformant planning. Okay? That means our non-sensing planning, or no-sense planning. Okay. The one issue is, of course, that one class of planners that actually solved conformant planning problems, the way they essentially operated it was slightly different. Rather than work on the belief state for each action, compute a new belief state. What they tried to do is the following thing. You have belief state, let's say S1, S2, or S3. Okay? Think in terms of expressed belief state. Now, what you would be doing in the way I'm explaining it to you is you would consider, let's say, doing A1, progress A1, and compute and find out that this might involve S4 or S5, and then A2, this might involve S7, S9, S10, and then A3, that might get you to S10 alone. Okay, so those are three branches. And then you try to progress from each of those branches. That's one way of doing it. Okay, another way of doing it is do the entire projection once. One level projection at a time. Okay? So the idea is you would try to do all of these actions, A1, A2, A3, together and generate these three belief states together. These three belief states together. Okay? And then, so there will be one single formula corresponding to all these three belief states, and then you apply to these set of belief states. Again, the entire transition function. When I'm applying all actions, in essence, what I'm saying is there is a single transition function for the entire domain, which says if you are in these states, these are the states that you can reach by doing these actions. Okay? If you are applying all of them together, then this is being called planning by model checking. Okay? And so the idea then is that you are in some sense doing a crazy breakfast search in the space of belief state. Okay? Now, what does this remind you of, if at all it reminds you of something? Planning graph. What's the difference between that and planning graph? What planning graph does is, if you remember the story I told you, I basically drew a graph. There are these crazy analogies that you have to keep in your mind. You know, I'm calling these states right now S1, S2, S3. These are states. If they become literals, this is classical planning. Right? Because if you think in terms of PQR, which is a state, which are the literals corresponding to a state, then it becomes classical planning. Because of which, so this is a thing to keep in mind, literals in classical planning are states in belief space planning. And several analogies will transfer over because of that connection. In fact, for example, you could have things like state mutexes, just as you have literal mutexes in classical planning. Okay. Anyway, so I drew a picture almost similar to this when I explained planning graph for you guys, except these were literals corresponding, that are the constituents of the state. And then I tried to do all actions, computed all the real states. I did that. But then remember, that was on the top level. And then that's not planning graph. The bottom level planning graph removes these distinctions between the states, these differences between the states. Okay, and so it becomes an approximate representation for the union of states that appear in the level one. That's why planning graph was an approximate representation. You can do this idea of planning as model checking also for classical planning. And what you would then be doing is you would have exact logical formulas corresponding to the exact set of states that are applicable in level one. And another exact logical formula corresponding to the exact set of states that are applicable in the level two. And in the worst case, you can't expect this to be any better than what you can see to be, which is breadth first search, blind breadth first search. You're just doing, you know, one level by another level by another level, true breadth first search. Okay. The reason this is even feasible, this is the reason why even people think about doing this, is it turns out that you know, if you that you can represent arbitrarily complex logical formulas as BDDs. That's point one. Okay. Point two, the thing that really makes a big difference is the transition function. The entire transition function of a domain can be represented itself as a BDD. And furthermore, the act of taking a big logical formula corresponding to a bunch of states and, you know, progressing it over all the actions that are relevant to it to get the next big logical formula, that can be represented as a simple BDD operation. Now, I'm talking at a high level. In fact, to understand this, you have to understand BDDs, and you have to understand exactly what happens in, you know, computing the next BDD. Yes?
The one problem of BDD is the parallel ordering.
Mm-hmm.
Size of BDD depends.
Yes, very much so.
So how do we find...
No, they don't make a major commitment as far as I'm concerned. There are heuristics to pick ordering, but you have to stick to one ordering. In fact, there is an appendix in the textbook, I think, you know, this one, C5 and C6, appendix C5 and C6, which talk for the first three pages about just this part, and then one page about BDDs. And one page about BDDs is not enough, unfortunately, you know. I'm mostly trying to explain to you what they meant by planning by model checking. Okay, and the reason it becomes worth doing is the operation of progressing a belief state through a transition function can be done entirely and efficiently in terms of operations and BDDs. Who would have thought, you know, but the fact that it is possible is a good thing. Okay, and so in essence they're doing a brute force search. Okay, so in fact there was, in the very beginning of the planning competition, there was a planner called BDD Plan, which did essentially this for classical planning. If you can do this for belief space planning, you can also do it for classical planning, right? Right? So essentially, if you think of S1, S2, S3 as literals themselves, all that matters is if they were actually real states, so, you know, there would be things like S1 would be P and Q and R, S2 would be P and not Q and not R, and so on. And there is an implicit disjunction over these formulas. That would be the full formula. Okay, that would be what happens in a belief space planning. If it's not belief space planning, then S1, S2, S3 themselves are literal. And what you have is an implicit conjunction there. So S1, the P is true, Q is true, R is true. Okay, but either way, there is a logical formula, and then which corresponds to a BDD, and there is a transition function. You compute the next logical formula corresponding to the next set of states. Okay, so the big deal here is BDDs can be used as an efficient representation of sets of states, where states essentially are, a state is a complete specification of truth falsity values to state variables. Yes, sir.
If, for example,
Google
is H5 and H7, what would you see from this graph that your best choice,
If the goal is here, no, it cannot. No. Sorry. So what happens is you would have to realize, I mean, this representation here cannot, it has to, I mean, the BDD representation of this formula should still be able to tell you that this is one belief state, this is one belief state, this is another belief state. In fact, if you're doing planning graph, then you would think, yeah, there's an S5 here, there's an S7 here, so I reached it. BDD presented, again, I'm doing it at a high level. The only way you can understand it is actually look at what the BDDs look like. But they do not differentiate, they're not removing the membranes between the belief states at all. So they are doing exact projection, which I called all sorts of bad names when I originally did, you know, planning graph. I showed something like this and said, nobody in their right mind would do this because it'll be too costly, so we would do this planning graph, which is an approximate thing, and use that approximation as a heuristic. But now, it turns out that, again, you know, one of the funny things is that it becomes more of a reasonable game when you have so much disjunction already in the initial state, because you are sunk anyway. And even though, in fact, it's not, there are this MBP, there is this one planner called MBP, it's called model-based planner. This is the group of Paolo Traverso, who is one of the authors of the book. You know, their group did it. Okay. Now, this, you know, MBP, it's not required that it must go one step, the entire transition one step at a time. It can continue, it can start saying A1 and A2 on this part, and A3 and A4 on this part. It can introduce disjunction. But the point is, it's able to deal with, if required, the entire transition function in progressing. That's a big deal. Okay. So the part that's hard is, if you look at the chapter on model-based planning, which you know, Paolo Traverso wrote, all the descriptions of what is done by the progression planner and the regression planner would be in terms of states, in terms of what I did last class. But then there is this interface layer which basically says all of these can also be done equivalently in the BDDs. So, you know, the only reason they actually work is because the entire projection operation can be seen as a BDD operation. Okay. I would suggest that you look at appendix C5 and C6 by next class. I'll also try to see if I can find a single small paper which gives you enough of a background to understand the innards of the BDD. Okay. If I don't find it, it's one more of the technologies that intersects with planning, but I'm not explaining completely here. For example, the whole entire integer programming I mentioned, I didn't explain. Okay. CSP I mentioned, I didn't explain. You know, so more of the issue is that this is one way of doing the main planning problem. Okay. But what your search is something that we cared about. We talked about what does it mean to, you know, terminate search in the belief space. Okay, those are more important for me. Okay. Any questions? Okay. What I'm going to do now is start having some little fun by bringing in the sensing actions and see how search changes because of sensing action. Okay. So sensing basically, sensing action is probably going to tell you the value of some formula which is defined over states. That's what a sensing action tells you. Okay? In the most general case, a sensing formula, P, I don't know, they normally write P as the sensing formula. A sensing formula P, you know, if it says yes, then you know that you must be in state S1 to S100, let's say. It'll only evaluate to true in those states. So if you have no clue which states you are in, right, then if you do phi and it says yes, you know that you are in states S1 to S100. You don't know which of them, but you reduce the uncertainty. That's the whole point of sensing. Okay? A particular form, sensing formula is just represented over the states. Okay, a particular special case of this would be the phi can be a particular state variable in your state in your state variable representation. Is the state variable P true? If it says yes, then you are only in those states where P is true. Everything else is out. Okay? And a more general case might be some logical formula. Is the state variable P and Q implies R and W? R and W. Is that true? That could be, you know, so here this is P, which is just saying, is the single state variable true? Just a second. And here is another P dash, which will say yes only if this formula evaluates to true. Okay? Now, this normally is called complex sensing, because you are essentially evaluating arbitrary formulas defined in terms of the state variables. And this is simple sensing in the sense you are actually evaluating a single state variable. But both of them ultimately are telling you which subsets of states you actually are currently in. Yes?
As far as I know, they can tell yes, no.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them can be useful.
Yes, yeah, no can also be useful. Yes, I agree. No, I'm just, yes, of course. I mean, if this is saying yes, then you're only in these. And so if the total number of states is 101, then in fact, P saying no is much more useful. That means you are in the 101st state. Yes, completely. I agree with you. Okay. Furthermore, of course, you know, you can also have multi-array sensing and all those syntactic sugaring. You know, a sensing action gives you different values, you know, based on that. Okay. Now, one complexity in sensing actions is whether they are complex sensing formulas or simple sensing. Simple sensing means whatever your representation is, within that representation, each sensing action tells you the status of a single state variable. Okay, a complex sensing means it's some arbitrary formula over that representation. Okay, the other issue is whether the sensing actions are, you know, have any preconditions and any causative effects, or whether they are just outside of the causative action. Remember, now we are talking about sensing. Sensing is an action. You do that. Okay, so the question is, you already have normal actions, which if you do them, they change the world. They first check whether or not certain things are true in the world. And if you do them, then they change the world. The question is, do sensing actions have preconditions? And can they have causative effects? In general, yes. When they, you know, try to figure out whether or not your brain is fried, they'll do a CAT scan. If they do too many of them, the brain will be fried. Okay, right? So there is a causative effect, you know, and so most sensing actions typically have both preconditions. Most general sensing actions typically have both preconditions and causative effects. But those are harder to deal with. And anytime I talk about harder and easier, then you can be sure that I'm going to deal with just the easier ones first. Okay, so I will mostly deal today with pure sensing actions, where they have no preconditions and they have no effects other than just the sensed formula. And those are the easiest ones to handle, and that itself already changes the nature of search significantly. Okay, and then, you know, there is other complexities involved, including whether you have complex sensing and whether you have sensing with causes and preconditions. Yes, sir. Yes, exactly. So that's a huge big deal, because sensing action is a pure sensing action changes only your knowledge, not the world. Okay? Now the hard part, of course, is in trying to change just your knowledge, sometimes you might wind up changing the world too, depending upon whether or not you have if you don't have pure sensing actions, right? Then, you know, what is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle saying? That there is no pure sensing action. You cannot sense the position of an electron without affecting its velocity. But you don't need Heisenberg for that. I mean, we already know that in many cases, you know, pure sensing actions are not possible. But we'll at least understand how to do that. You had a quick point? Mm-hmm.
That, like, you can express sensing and causative action.
But the causative effects is a problem.
So you just keep an action cause effect that enables a sensing theory is sensing action cause zero, and you have to disable the sensing theory before you start acting.
Yeah, so we'll let's first understand the pure sensing. It may or may not, I'm not quite sure myself, but I, you may be right. But
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think
yeah. Currently, we'll. So the first thing we'll do. I'll get to that in hopefully after the class. But let me at least get you to pure sensing actions and how that changes the search. Okay. Now, sensing actions. First of all, have two different aspects to them: during runtime versus during planning time. Okay. During runtime, they reduce your uncertainty. You do the sensing during runtime, you reduce uncertainty. During planning time, you are, so the point about sensing actions and planning is kind of a weird thing. Why would I make a plan which involves sensing and not do it so that I would do it tomorrow? That's basically what you're doing. You know, when you're putting a sensing action into the plan, that in essence is saying tomorrow I'll wake up and I'll check this literal. If it says true, I will do something, false, I'll do something else. Okay, sensing action during planning, all it does is it partitions, it introduces a branch into the plan. Because you sense, now you have to deal with, I mean, unless you want to just, I will check whether P is true, I'll hope it will be true and I'll only do this, you know, that makes no sense. That's not a reasonable plan. So if you're going to check P, then you have to consider the possibility that it will come true or come false. And then, so you need to know what to do if P is true and what to do if P is false. Whereas if you are interleaving planning and execution, then you can sense in the current state whether P is true or false, and if it's saying P is true, then you only do the, you know, plan for that at that point of time. Okay. So at the plan time, sensing actions partition belief state. So in fact, if you were to take a belief state and you apply a sensing action, a pure sensing action, okay, then that which says is P true, then it partitions that belief states into two belief states. You know, the first partition are all the states where P is true, second partition are all the states where P is false. Okay, and now you have to take both these belief states to the goal state. Okay, both belief states to the goal state. In doing this, essentially, you know, the notion of the sensing actions, the amount of sensing actions that are available to you essentially distinguish between whether the domain is fully observable, completely unobservable, or partially observable. Okay? If you have no sensing actions, that essentially means if you're given the entire set of states, S1 to Sn, then that's the total number of states in your domain. Then, if you have no sensing, then all of them are indistinguishable for you. There is nothing you can do to tell which of those states you are in at all during runtime. I'm talking about runtime. Okay. Now, if all I have is one sensing action which only tells me whether the literal P is true or false, then all of a sudden originally, my states are represented in three state variables, P, Q, and R. Okay? And I only have one single sensing action which tells me whether P is true or not. Then all I'm able to do is all the states where P is true are indistinguishable from each other. All the states when P is false are indistinguishable from each other. But these two are separate classes. I know which class I am in by doing this sensing action. Okay? So sensing sort of introduces this idea called observational classes. Okay? And if you have full sensing, then each observational class that you can distinguish from other observational class, so you can think of an observational class as a set of states. It's basically a partition on the original set of states. Now, if the partition is such that each observation class is a singleton, that means you have full sensing. If it is such, actually I think that's, I'll get to it in a minute. Okay, so this is basically what I was saying. If the partition is such that the state space is partitioned to singleton states because of the observation, then you have full observability. If the state space is in one single partition, then you have no observability. Anywhere in between, you have partial observability. Okay? By removing sensing actions, you can reduce the observability. Okay? And in general, both non-observability and full observability are easy for planners in some sense. Okay, if in terms of search. Okay. In terms of execution, it's clearly which world would you rather live in? Fully unobservable world or fully observable world? Fully observable world. Okay. Planning, it turns out, is more complex if you have the observability, because you have to actually take that into account. Okay. To put this in little more concrete terms, so you had previously you had initial state and some operators and some goal states. Now what you also have now is a set B of observable state variables. I'm assuming simple sensing is only possible. Okay. So I only have a set B of observable state variables, and for each of those variables there is a unique sensing action which tells me whether that variable is true or false. That's one simple kind of planning with sensing. Okay. So in this case, now if the sense the set B of the variables that can be sensed is always obviously a subset of the variables that you do have, original set of variables that are representing your states, and if it is a subset of if it is a proper subset, that means it's partially observable. If it is equal, that means it's fully observable. If B is empty, then it is non-observable. Okay. Okay. And then the, in terms of hardness of planning, I already mentioned earlier whether sensory actions give us full or partial observability winds up being important. Full observability is better than partial observability. And whether the sensing itself is complex or simple, that means is it on individual fluents or formulas. And then finally, whether sensing actions are always applicable or whether they have preconditions and effects. Again, we were basically looking at the simplest case right now. Okay. Any questions? Yes. Right now, yes. Right now, yes. So in general, if you have stochasticity, right, then you can say P true. I mean, if you do this action, it will tell you with certain probability whether P is true or not. Okay. There is no point in having non-deterministic sensing actions. Well, there is one. For example, a complex sensing action can be a non-deterministic sensing action. In the sense, you know, the formula P basically evaluates P or Q. That's a complex sensing action. So it will be true in every state where P or Q, the formula, winds up being true. The only thing is you don't get to say whether the degree of truth of this P or Q. Is it 0.9, etc. You know, it's either, it will only split the states into those states where P or Q is completely true, and those states where PRQ is completely false. Okay? It's a good question. And when you go to PalmDBs, we have to worry about the distribution too. Okay? Because you actually have stochastic information about the sensing too. Okay? So here is the simplest algorithm. So I already told you that during planning, if you do a sensing action, you introduce a partition into the search space. Right? And so here is my progression algorithm, which does that essentially. Basically, I will take a belief state and a goal and what is P? Yeah, a belief state and the goal. And what I'm trying to do is either choose a causative action A that is applicable in B. Okay, here are two things. Either I can do one or two during every time this procedure is called. Okay. Either I can non-deterministically choose one of the causative actions that is applicable. Okay, that means it has no sense. It's not a sensing action. Remember that now I'm separating causative actions from sensing actions. Okay, so I pick one of the causative actions and I'll go ahead and apply that action to this belief state, and I'll generate a new belief state. It'll be a single belief state. Okay? And so then I would then recursively call myself on the belief state that appears after, you know, action A is applied to B. Okay? And now my current plan, the P is the current plan till now. Okay? P is called with empty set, empty sequence. Now, the recursive calls will say, well, your current plan is whatever your previous plan is plus an action A. Okay? And the second aspect of this is, this much you already knew. This is just normal belief space planning. Now here, without sensing action. Now once you have a sensing action, you choose one of the sensing actions, any sensing action that you would like, and such that S senses A, actually, in fact, I'm thinking of, you know, simple the sensing action, so it actually does not sense a formula, it just senses a state variable, F. Okay? And then what I would be doing is I have two plans, I have two calls, two recursive calls now. Okay? One corresponding to, because this thing, this sensing action S tells me whether the fluent F is true or false. So in essence, in one side, you know, one side I would know that I am in B and F, belief state. So if the belief state is represented as a logical formula, the subset of those belief states where literal F is true is nothing but the conjunction of that logical formula with F. Right? And then so I would call B and F on the same goal with an empty plan. And then on this other side, I'll call B and not F with the same goal with an empty plan. Okay? And when they both return, then I will essentially introduce a branch corresponding to my sensing action, saying if my sensing action said F is true, do the plan this guy returned. If not, do the plan this guy returned. That's it.
So the plan is an NOR
wrap? It's a plan, is a tree now. Plan is essentially an, you know, a plan looks like, you know, there are sensing actions. Whenever you do the sensing action, you have to consider if for the plan to be complete normally, you know, you have to do what happens on both sides. Now, this, if in this particular algorithm, if I keep calling only one and I succeed, then I would have gotten a non-sensing plan. Right? Yeah, I would have gotten just a non-sensing plan. And the ratio with which I will call two depends on how much sensing I do. You know, there it's, in fact, one of the interesting things is that we haven't talked about cost metrics for plans. Now, should more sensing better or less sensing better? So, in fact, previously, all you could do when you didn't have sensing actions is there would be plans of length, you know, L1 and L2. And if all actions are equally created, then you say L1 is bigger than L2, then this plan is not as good as this plan. If there are non-uniform cost actions, you add up the action costs and see which number is bigger. When you have sensing thrown in, then you are comparing one tree to another tree. Okay, or one tree to another path. And so you need to actually talk about sensing costs too. Okay, in general, given a single plan, single problem, you may have plans which do over-sensing and plans which don't do any sensing at all. And depending upon the cost of actions, sensing actions and the, you know, causative actions, the optimum may involve doing no sensing or optimum might involve doing full sensing. And my example for this, of course, is if your doctor essentially tries not to do too much sensing because your insurance doesn't pay for most of the tests. Okay, so as soon as you go, they'll give you an antibiotic. I assume that you know, George Bush's doctor thinks sensing first. You know, let's do as, you know, money is no objective, so we'll do all the sensing and make sure what he's really suffering from before we treat him. Okay, so optimum for George Bush's doctor is different from optimum from your doctor, and the problem could well be the same essentially. And how much sensing you do. Now, an interesting thing is paths in this search tree, I mean, in this search algorithm correspond to both over-sensing and, you know, less-sensing versus more-sensing plans. Okay. Of course, you have to talk about heuristics such that you can find the optimal plans. But one tricky point is, what is this search? We were talking about heuristics all along for one type of search, A star search, where in A star search, a solution eventually is a path in a graph. Right? Now we are no longer talking about A star search, we are talking about the solutions now are trees. Okay? So it turns out that enter AO star search, which actually is a general case of A star search, which none of you guys ever get taught anymore. When I used to do intro to AI, we were taught AO star search. Okay? And it's actually just as useful, I mean, it has at least as much, there are general scenarios where AO star search winds up being a very good algorithm. And so there are lots of work that's been done on talking about computing, getting heuristics for AO star search, properties of AO star search, et cetera, et cetera. The old Nielsen's book from which Nielsen's Intro to AI, which is one of the first real Intro to AI books, you know, that had an entire chapter on AO star search. And I actually, you know, copied that from Nielsen's book. Okay? So it's worth for us to understand what AO star search is, because that's essentially what we are doing. You know, this algorithm is doing, it's an undeterministic algorithm. If you want to convert into a search algorithm and throw in heuristics, etc., then it won't be an A star search, it will be AO star search. Okay? So what is an AO star search? A star search finds a path in, so AO star search looks like this. Okay, so here, you know, this is my graph. This is called an AND OR graph. Okay, an AND OR graph essentially has, and here are the bunches of nodes, and from the node N0, I have two operations possible. This operation which takes me to N1, and this operation which takes me to N5 and N4. Okay, the usual way of thinking about AO star search is problem reduction. Okay, so you had a big problem, N0, that you had to solve. You can solve it by reducing it to another problem called N1 and solving that, or you can solve it by reducing it to two problems called N5 and N4 and solving both of them. Okay, this is basically that's why it's called a problem reduction search. Okay, and then if you come to N1, then you can solve it by either converting it to N3 or to N2. Now, when do you get done? There are a subset of nodes here which are called terminating nodes. Okay? If your path ends, if every leaf node, I mean, every ending point of that your path is a terminating node, then that path is a solution. And then you consider which are cheaper versus costlier solutions based on the cost matrix you provide for these edges. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so AO star really is just a general case of A star search. If in fact the funny thing that you had, the only funny thing that you had is these kinds of branches. These are called the AND branches. Okay, if you pick, in fact, all branches are considered AND branches. This is an AND branch of arity 2. Okay, this is an AND branch of arity 1. Okay, and in this case, in fact, there is all the AND branches happen to have arity 2, but that's not necessary normally. In AO star, you can take a single problem and split it into three small problems, and you solve all of them, you would be done with the first one. Okay, so now the question, of course, is what is a solution? A solution is an AND subtree of the AND OR graph. A solution is an AND subtree of the AND OR graph. That's what it is. Okay? And now, of course, if all the AND branches have arity 1, then AO star becomes A star. Okay? To understand heuristics, and even admissible or inadmissible heuristics for planning with sensing, you need to start talking about AO star search, not A star search. Okay, so here is just a little thing for this particular. Now, in our case, basically, you know, if I was, this is my belief state, I could have done a causative action and come to this belief state. Or I could have done a sensing action and come to this or this belief state. And a belief state would be terminating if it's a goal belief state. That means every state in this is a goal state. Is part of the goal belief state. So that's what that guy was doing. Okay? And so, you know, an under search looks, you know, sort of, if you want to see how the search works, of course, you could, in this case, this is just a couple of slides showing how the search might progress. You started from N0, you decided to go this way, so you got N1, but since you expanded N0, you know these two are hanging about, okay? Then next, you have used some numbers. So basically, you have used whatever heuristics to decide it's better to expand this instead of expanding this AND graph further. This AND tree further, I mean AND node further. Yes, sir. Yes, see, HTN is sort of problem. In fact, well, it's the opposite way. You should think of HTN as this kind of problem solving. In the sense that HTN essentially is taking a task and splitting it into subtasks. Okay, but they put an ordering also among them. But you can think of HTN as some sort of essentially problem reduction search. Okay. But that, you know, this is a much more general, low-level framework. You know, these nodes can be anything. They can be belief states. They can be partial plans. They can be anything you want. Okay, just like A star search. You could use A star search in learning. You can do it in planning. You can do it anywhere, right? So you know. So the question is, you would be stuck with your state. So you know, when I wrote this non-deterministic search tree here, it wasn't obvious to you what would be in the search queue. In the search queue, it's not just a bunch of belief states. There is parenthesis among the belief states. Okay, either you work on this or you must work on these two guys, right? And that becomes very clear when you come here. So either you can go from here, expand this, in which case you can either go this way or this way, or you decide to work on this, in which case you are committing to work on both of them. Okay, and of course the interesting thing now is that you might go a little bit further on one of these sub-problems and you realize that it's not solvable, and if it's not solvable, there's no point in working on this anymore, because these two work together. If you can't solve this, there's no point in working on this. Then you shift over to a different R branch. Okay, so that's basically, so in this case, you know, there are much more solutions, much more slides, but you know, after four cycles, it might look like this. And you have to remember at each node which was the direction you were going. Now that's what AO star search remembers in terms of marks. Yes.
How are you determining the direction by? I mean, is that just
which directions to go, you mean? Oh yeah, no, I mean, basically you have to remember the AND branches. You need to know when there's an AND branch, you need to realize that I have to work on this as well as this. Okay?
Yeah.
So your search, the state of your search would look like this. See, in A star search, what does the state of search look like? It looks like a partial tree. In AO star search, it looks like this partial AND or graph. That's what it is. That's exactly how it looks. Okay. Okay. So I would, next class when we come back, we would actually spend more time on heuristics for both confirmment and conditional planning. There is not that many great ideas on heuristics for conditional planning. I'll tell you now itself. Okay. But we do have bunches of ideas on confirmment planning heuristics, and one heuristic you already know for confirmment planning. Which is what? No. You just solve the classical planning problem. No, there are lots of the planning graph is fine, but if you have a confirmment problem, so you think that you are in either initial state I1 or I2, right, and you need to reach goal state G, ignore the uncertainty. Say you are in I1, let's say. and find a plan for that. That would be classical planning, assuming that there are no non-deterministic actions. If you have non-deterministic actions, pick one future for each of them and find a classical plan. The true length of that classical plan is going to be a lower bound than the true length of the conformant plan. Admissible. You could do worse than that. You know, you could say, you know, H equal to zero is the dumbest idea you can come up with. So in fact, when you come to conformant planning, one of the nice things is conformant planning is can use classical planning as its relaxation. But we will see a better version than that. Okay? So that's basically what we will do next class. And let me see, is there anything else? One thing actually I have to do, I guess this is the other thing that I'll also do next class, which is how to handle, this is an example of doing sensing in a particular case. I'll do a couple of examples in the beginning of next class. One, this one, the other is more interesting, the medication one, okay. You should look at the slides already, and then we can quickly go through just doing that search, and we'll also talk about heuristics. We'll say a little about regression in the space of belief states while doing sensing. It's painful, in the sense that it's not as easy to, you know, get it right, okay. And then there is also, for everything, you know, for confinement planning, you know, especially for conditional planning, you can also do it as a plan space planning. And in fact, one of the first conditional planners was this planner called CNLP, which came in like 1992. First cleanly written conditional planner was CNLP. And David Smith, who wrote that planner, got the Classic Paper Award last year. So, you know, which also means that nobody is using it anymore. So he's old. But, you know, there is, you can also do conditional planning using partial order planning. Okay, but I'm just going to do one algorithm and how to handle that search and then move on. So that's what we'll stop.